Welcome to the Marine Mammal Science Podcast, the podcast for cutting-edge science and the latest conservation news about whales and dolphins, seals and sea lions, manatees, and other marine mammals.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest episode of the Marine Mammal Science Podcast. And today I'm joined by Dr. Lorelei Creera, who's an associate professor at George Mason University in the Department of Biology. And arguably, she's one of the world experts on the Stella sea cow. How are you doing, Lorelei?
I'm well today. How are you?
I'm grand. So, first of all, what is the Stella sea cow? Why is it so special? And also, could you tell us a little bit about the man who actually discovered them, Stella, who has quite an interesting story?
Sure. This is an animal that I can always freak my undergraduates out with because I tell them it's a manatee that was 30 feet long. And then we talk about the fact that that's from the front of the classroom all the way to the back of the classroom, you know, the size of a small whale. And they get a little freaked out by that. But this was a northern animal, the only Sirenian that lived in cold water. And it was discovered by a very interesting German guy whose original name was Georg Stoller, and he changed his name a little bit when he went to Russia so that the Russians could pronounce it, and that's why we know him as Stoller now. But he was a classic naturalist from his time. He was really broad. He did geology and, you know, herpetology and ornithology and plants and everything. So he was a kind of an interesting guy. Serious jerk, apparently, but an interesting guy. And he found the sea cows when, so he was with Bering on the second northern, great northern expedition, and he found the sea cows on the way back to Russia when their boat ran into what was to become Bering Island. And they were there, if you can think about that, in the North Pacific from November of 1741 until August of 1742, but across the winter just must have been insane trying to survive up there in that barren island in the middle of nowhere, you know. So, but he made it for a couple of years and got back to Russia and took lots of samples with him, including maybe the upper roof plate of a Steller sea cow. But he called them the Great Northern Manatee, which I thought was an interesting name too. And he only lived for like 4 years after that and ended up dying on his way back to Russia, being recalled by Peter the Great's daughter, Catherine, to answer to the charges of being a slacker scientist who didn't do any work.
Well, I'm glad that doesn't happen these days.
Never. Well, it turned out that his boxes were just, you know, not getting back to the capital and his reports weren't getting back. So, you know, he actually got there before all of his stuff did. So, yeah, I don't know how you can really accuse somebody in the 1700s of not getting stuff done when it takes months to move something from one place to another.
So he famously has the Stella Sea Eagle, the Stella Sea Lion.
Oh, there's a list.
Amongst other things named after him.
Yeah.
But how did his crew manage to survive on this tiny, remote, basically frozen, deserted island? It's a really extreme environment.
It was a really extreme environment. The only reason that they survived, even though they would probably never have admitted it, was because of Stellar. Honestly, and lots and lots and lots of them did not survive, including Bering, who died of scurvy. Oh, not too long after they ran into the island. He was already sick with it before they ran into Bering Island. I love the irony of the fact that that island is only about 100 miles off the coast of Kamchatka. So they were really close to getting back. And if they hadn't run into that island, they probably would have made it. But lots and lots of them died. Stellar had said tons of times, hey, you guys, you know, if you don't get some greens, you're going to end up with scurvy and then you're going to get really sick and all your teeth are going to fall out and worse things. So he would recommend sea plants or land plants that they would come across to help out. And he was always mad in his journal. He would go on about how the sailors wouldn't follow his advice and were all just looking to get scurvy. He couldn't even convince Bering, actually, that he should eat some of these plants and stay healthy. But eventually, in the spring, so he made a lot of notes on four different animals up on Bering Island, the sea lion that was going to be called Steller's sea lion, the fur seal, the sea cow, and the sea otter. And the Russians were really interested in that sea otter because the pelt was worth a ton. So they were trying to take back as many pelts as they could for the furring industry at the time, which was another thing that it seemed like everything made Steller mad. Maybe he should have recorded days in his journal where he was having a good day. I don't know. But he was mad about the sea otters too, because there wasn't any room on the boat for him to take. He had stuffed a baby sea cow. Can you imagine? He stuffed a baby sea cow and he didn't get to bring that back because there wasn't any room because of the sea otter pelts. It just filled the entire lower hold of this boat. So just crazy. But this guy was really widely read. He, you know, like most naturalists of his time, he just knew so many different things. He was always grumpy about the fact that he couldn't draw, which he thought that other scientists did much better than he did. Very rare that he would ever say anything like that. But he had read somewhere about a technique for whaling from the shore. And so when they saw these sea cows out there, they said, well, maybe we could fashion some kind of a hook and hook onto one and just drag it in on shore and kill it and eat it. They had no idea what it was going to taste like, but Steller had read that manatee was good. So that's what they did. And that was what kept him alive. It was the eating sea cows that sustained them for the rest of that winter and on through the next summer. So he did mention quite a number of times that sea otter is terrible to eat. It tastes awful. The babies are semi-palatable, but the adults are just not very tasty at all. And he said all kinds of things that are always a mystery to me. Like he said that if you took the meat from a sea cow and put it into a barrel with its own fat, the meat wouldn't actually spoil, which is pretty cool. I mean, for a group of people who didn't have a refrigerator, I guess they probably didn't need one there for the first part of their time on Bering Island. But they ate most of the things that they brought in. They killed a lot of what he called the sea bears. That's the fur seals. So they ate that and didn't think it was all that tasty. And they would catch, of course, any kind of fish that they could or anything like that. But they were in real trouble for food and in real trouble for scurvy. And as soon as he finally got them eating some greenery, the health of the crew really improved. So, you know, that was an astonishing thing. But, you know, it was the sea cows that kept those guys going. And then the sea cows actually fed the sea otter furring industry for a number of years after that. And that led to the sea cow population declining so rapidly that they couldn't recover from it. And they went extinct in 1768. So we only really knew about them for 27 years before they were gone. So, interesting story.
So your research on this mammal that went extinct just a few hundred years ago wasn't on Bering Island. It was a different location. So can you explain what your research discovered?
Well, there had been people who had written across time that the sea cow probably inhabited the whole of the North Pacific, including the other big island that's up there, which is St. Lawrence. There are a ton of little islands that dot from Alaska all the way over to Russia. But at the top of the whole Bering Sea area, there's St. Lawrence Island. And so there was a guy, O'Haron, I think his last name was, who said he thought that there was no reason why the sea cow couldn't live on St. Lawrence Island. And all the bones that we have here in DC were actually brought back to the Smithsonian by Steiniger. So those all came from Bering Island. So we did do some DNA extraction from some of those bones and didn't really get very much out of it. But I did have one bone that was kind of a loner that wasn't a part of the Smithsonian collection that we did DNA extraction on. And we used that as our main comparison sample for these bones that we were getting that people kept telling me were coming from St. Lawrence Island. So now my brother called me up, almost didn't finish my PhD on this day, actually. My brother calls me up and he says, "I'm standing in front of a box of Steller's sea cow bone. Do you want any?" And, you know, I just about had a heart attack and said, "Yes, yes." So he brought back a couple of pieces of bone from the Blade Show, which happens in Atlanta every year. This material, when you polish it and cut it, it's so beautiful. It looks sort of like wood. It feels like wood. It has that kind of warm feeling that wood has. It's got beautiful grain to it. So people who make high-end custom knives will frequently make the handles out of Steller sea cow. So that's why they had these bones at the show. And that was where we started getting the bones that everybody was saying they're coming from St. Lawrence Island, from St. Lawrence Island. By that point in my research, I'd also gotten some little carved items. I have a humpback whale and calves and a couple of turtles and some skulls and a horse and other little things that people have carved out of something. And they were saying that these were carved out of Steller sea cow bone from St. Lawrence Island. And they could document that because they're being carved there. And what we found was that all of those little pieces that I had gotten before we started getting the raw pieces of bone were in fact Steller sea cow bone. There was a published sequence from the mitochondrial DNA done in 1997, and our sequence compared to that one extremely well. In fact, there was only one or two differences across that space. So, you know, it was evidence for a whole new population of sea cows that had lived up there at St. Lawrence. And when we dated those bones, most of them are about 1,000 years old. So that population went extinct sometime about 1,000 years before 1950. So pretty astonishing.
So why do you think that they went extinct?
I think we ate them to extinction.
So like in Bering Island?
Yeah. Well, it probably wasn't quite as bad as that, because as soon as you've got something as big as the fur trade rolling over a little population of long-lived, slow-breeding animals, they're gone. Mm. That's it. So these guys may have been so far north that they had a lot of trouble up there anyway, and they probably were preyed upon. We have stories coming out of St. Lawrence Island that say that people used their ribs and hide to make canoes out of, which makes complete sense. As soon as you hold one of these ribs in your hand, it's a heavy item. It certainly would make an incredibly good canoe rib. So, you know, they were useful for that. And once you start preying on a population of big, long-lived, slow-breeding animals, they just can't handle it.
And about 1,000 years ago as well would have been the height of the medieval warm period, I suppose, too.
That could have been a problem as well, because it may have affected their food source, which is really important.
And their food source was primarily kelp, according to Steller?
It was, yeah. They ate just about every form of algae and kelp that grows right next to the shore. Steller said that they would come almost into shore and eat from the kelp that was growing there. He was always funny because he said that they were so greedy that they would put their heads underwater for so long that it seemed like they were going to drown before they would come up and breathe. I don't think he wrapped his brain around the fact that they had lungs that were bigger than he was. Staying underwater for a couple of minutes isn't that big a deal.
Well, didn't he also say that they couldn't sink as well?
Yes, he did say that. And that is the kind of thing that just freaks Sirenian biologists out. This makes no sense. These animals are built to sink. I mean, all of them are. Their bones are thick and heavy. They have no marrow in their bones. So they do all that blood production stuff with their spleen, at least the modern ones that we have now. So sea cow, probably similar. But, you know, they're built to sink. So why would they spend all their time out of the water? I mean, it bothers me, but Steller was such a good observer. You know, he probably had all those cows numbered and knew every single one and, you know, came to the same place, knew who mated with who, and or at least he thought he did, all kinds of things. But, you know, that's lots of people doubt some of the things that Steller wrote about. My favorite, of course, as you know, is the sea monkey.
Yeah, this is a favorite of cryptozoologists, the famous Steller sea monkey.
Mythical beast. Oh my gosh, awesome. Steller sea monkey, very non-politically correctly described as an old Chinese guy with a mustache.
Oh dear.
Well, you know, it was the 1700s, so I don't think they invented political correctness. Yeah, it was an animal that swam around the boat. It swam under the boat. It hung around with them for a couple of hours. They took a couple of shots at it with a harpoon to try and kill one. He said that they saw another one somewhere along the way. I can't remember exactly where that was, but no one has ever figured out what that is. Some people say that they think it's a fur seal. It was a fur seal with a nice long mustache. And I think they're wrong about that, because I think Steller was far too good an observer not to know what a fur seal looked like. So it doesn't make any sense he didn't know a fur seal when he saw it. So
yeah, he saw plenty of fur seals and recognized the Steller sea lion was a different species. So,
well, yeah, if you can tell a sea lion from a fur seal, you've got to have at least something going on.
It couldn't possibly be a walrus. Surely you'd have seen those too.
It doesn't sound like a walrus either. He never mentions walrus.
You'd have thought he mentioned the tusks.
You know, that chestnut-colored piebald description that kind of bothers me. I mean, this had to be something that was white and reddish-brown in spots. So, of course, there could be translation errors there because, you know, he wrote either in Latin or in German, and then that got translated to Russian and then back into English later on. But Steiniger doesn't know what it was either, and he's not willing to dismiss it himself. So I figure if Steiniger says it was probably something, then it was probably something. Things have gone extinct. Why not that?
That's true. And that's such a remote area. If something had gone extinct, I mean, if it hadn't been for Steller, we probably wouldn't have even known the Steller sea cow went extinct.
No, we never would have. Because, you know, it would have been just a note in the logs. We caught these big, huge whales and we ate them. And that's what it would have been. It would have been we caught these whales. But, you know, kind of nice that Bering Island leaped in front of them that day and kept them from going back and let Steller examine the populations up there. So, interesting guy.
Yeah, although if they hadn't told anyone about the sea otters, then they might have stayed in for longer.
Yeah, that would have been intelligent. But, you know, as a conservationist before his time, he did say in his letter to Tsar Peter, he said, you know, if you don't stop these people from hunting the sea otters the way that they're doing and hunting the sea cows, they're going to go extinct. Hardly anybody even believed in extinction at the time, so it's a crazy statement.
It's true. They thought the oceans were an inexhaustible resource back then. Yeah,
absolutely. And all species were created, you know, by the deity placed there and unchangeable. But, you know, Steller, he definitely was thinking ahead of his time. So interesting.
So in terms of your study, then, your brother found the Steller sea cow. But I think we should emphasize that he has a forge and he makes knives and things, so that's why he was at a why he was at a blade show. So
he makes beautiful knives.
In fact. Yeah,
you have a harpoon hanging on your wall right now that my brother made for you?
He made me a historically accurate harpoon, which I use in presentations about historical whaling and various other things like that.
Brilliant. He's very talented, my brother. He brought that bone back, and then the next year he called me when they were getting ready to go down there, and he said, do you want to go? And so I went down to Atlanta with them, and I was able to get some other pieces of bone. Some of the pieces that I got that particular year were very beautifully polished, and some of them we already know, just from morphology, they're definitely not Steller sea cow. But we haven't been able to, well, let's put this differently. When I was doing this in 2010-ish, there was nothing in the NCBI BLAST database that matched our sequence for those samples. So across the years, I've tried to entice my undergraduate students into doing some research on some of these samples that we know for positive are not Steller's cCow, but we haven't ever been able to identify them genetically. So, I mean, the database has gotten exponentially larger since 2010. So I'm sure that some of these probably are identifiable at this point.
Oh, perhaps they're Steller's sea monkey.
Maybe they are. Maybe, and we'll never identify them.
Yeah.
As far as I know, they don't have a Steller sea monkey in the Smithsonian.
Talking of the Smithsonian, you told me that when you analyzed the Smithsonian samples, they actually came back as rat.
Yeah, we had some of them come back as rat, and I had to dig into that a little bit more. And when I was talking to the curator at the time, Charlie Potter, I told him that we had gotten positive rat results on some of the Smithsonian samples. And he looks at me and he goes, "Ah, that makes sense to me." And I said, "Well, it doesn't make any sense to me. It was a sea cow." He said, "Well, yeah, but those bones were in the bottom of the old castle. They weren't in, I mean, now it's like that last scene in Indiana Jones, you know, you walk through a couple of doors, really seriously, a couple of doors, over a sticky pad that takes all the stuff off the bottom of your shoes, into this hermetically sealed room, and it just seems like it goes on forever. There are crates and crates of stuff in there that nobody probably knows what they are. Maybe there's an Ark of the Covenant in there somewhere."
Yeah, it does look like the Indiana Jones scene with the warehouse.
It really does. And it's especially when you first walk in, because none of the lights are on. So the lights turn on down that long hallway, and it's just crazy. But that's a beautiful facility, a really, you know, hygienic and sealed facility. And apparently the bones were in the bottom of the castle for years and years, and they had rats that would come in and chew on them and pee on them. So it was probably rat urine that we were able to extract from those bones. I mean, you're going to extract 100% the most modern DNA easily over something that's several thousand years old. So doesn't really surprise me too much. It was a good story from Charlie Potter to let me know I wasn't insane, though.
So in terms of you analyzing these bone samples, I think we should emphasize to the listeners that these bone samples are not illegal because they're not protected under CITES because they're extinct. You can't make them any more extinct than they already are by trading them, like carving Siberian mammoth ivory or taking trilobite fossils or something like that.
Same kind of thing. People get mad about it, though, still, because they feel like all of these bones should be in a museum. But, you know, honest to goodness, our museums can't hold everything that's out there. So I've been trying to collect as many as I can for George Mason. And we keep them in our George Mason bone repository. Highly beautiful and amazing display of bones.
And most of the samples you have are just cubes, basically, as well.
Yeah, a lot of them are, if you think about it, the pieces that I have are designed to be made into knife handles. So the pieces of bone are 4 to 6 inches long, and they're all rib. And Steller's sea cow rib is very distinctive. I mean, it's not what you would expect for an animal that big. It's fairly narrow. You know, the ribs are maybe 2 inches at their widest point, and then oval-shaped. But you know, some of the other pieces of bone that we have are just massive compared to these Steller's sea cow ribs, which is pretty astonishing. So, but I went back to the Blade Show a number of years. I think we're up almost to 300-ish pieces of bone at this point. And most of it has actually been Steller's sea cow. So that's good.
Do you know how many individuals your samples are coming from, or haven't you gone into that yet?
You know, it's astonishing that we even got, considering the way that we do our work. I mean, we're not in a big, huge lab. We're in the back room of an ecology lab. So we've cobbled together the stuff that we work with and We use PCR machines that belong to other people, and usually we send our DNA out for sequencing because, A, it's cheaper. And I mean, buying the reagents and stuff that you need to do DNA sequencing is, wow, I could buy like a supercar for that. Anyway, we send most of that out, but we've done really well, I think, for what we do. And it's amazing that we were able to even find that we had any nuclear DNA. So yeah, we're still working on a project. I mean, we do our is this CCAO or not anyway. But right now, I guess for the last, 5 years, 6 years, we've been working on trying to identify, is this bone from Bob and this bone from Alice, or are these both from Bob? Because you can't tell just by looking at it. Mm. And that's the process of extracting microsatellite DNA, which is little tiny repetitive pieces of DNA in your genome. And it's with a couple of different locations in the genome, you can actually go down to the individual level. Some of the stuff that we've been working on with the mitochondria is really only good for population level or even species level identification. But with microsatellites, you can get to individual level. And we do know that we have a couple of different individuals, but we've only been able to do microsatellite analysis on maybe six or eight samples. So in that, we know we have 6 different samples out of 8. So that's good. we don't really know how many individuals we've got. So I imagine it's not going to be 300.
But when you were doing this analysis, you developed a test to sort of relatively quickly work out whether or not they were stellar CCAOs.
Yeah.
And I know you've had some interesting results in some of the supposed stellar CCAO, or they call it mermaid ivory.
They're
selling it.
That's kind of a cool name, isn't it? But Irenian, you know, that comes from mermaids. So I still love that quote by Columbus. He wrote about the manatees in his journal, and he said, "They're not half so beautiful as I thought they would be." he was talking about mermaids. So yeah, I think you have to be on a boat a really long time to think that a manatee is beautiful at all. I mean, they have a
great life. At that time they were getting through probably about 3 pints of rum a day.
I'm sure they were. Yeah, look at that thing. Clearly a human female. But yeah, I was trying to figure out a good way to, because this stuff is sold, you know, and you don't really know. Sometimes it's just sold as a slice of bone, just something that's across the rib and maybe a little less than a centimeter in width. Mm. So you can't tell at all from morphology what that bone came from. So we were thinking that it would be kind of nice to be able to easily figure out whether you had something that was legal to sell, like the CCAO, or something that was illegal to sell, like, well, pretty much anything else that's up there now. So we did find that one of the pieces of our, one of the sections of the DNA that we were looking at, which is called the D loop of the mitochondria, or the control region, same thing. One of those pieces was really good diagnostically to say, is this thing a Sirenian? We couldn't tell manatee from dugong from CCAO, but we didn't care, because dugongs and manatees don't hang out in the North Pacific very often, ever, actually.
Be a very lost dugong, yeah.
But it really was good. It was good at taking away everything else. No, so we had some samples from whale, little pieces of bone that you brought me, actually, that tested out to be whale. And that was one of the ones we used to try and figure out if it would pick up whales. And we did a couple of different whales, and that led us to, I wonder whether all of our samples are CCAO. And we found that they weren't. And interestingly enough, all the ones that aren't CCAO that we found so far have come from one cellar. So we know that we have a couple of other bones throughout the collection that aren't sea cow, but we don't know what they are. And we can look at them and say, aha, this is not sea cow. But what is it? We don't know. Like I said, we have to have to compare that to the database now and see what we get.
So seeing as they're coming from one cellar, do you think that they may be accidentally picking up whale bones from the middens that where they're collecting basically the sort of historical trash sites and happening to find
100% possible. Absolutely.
So why aren't the other sellers also picking up whales? Or do you think they might be sneaking in illegally caught animals? I guess it's hard to tell.
I don't know. That could be too, but I mean, it's hard to say. The middens that are on St. Lawrence Island, they don't seem like they're policed. The island itself is policed. So, you know, not just anybody can get there. You have to actually have permission from the council. And you have to know there's two big cities on the island and they have to know where you're going to go and who you're going to see and all kinds of stuff, which is one of the reasons I never ended up going up there, even though I wanted to. But, you know, it's possible that they're picking them up from middens. It's possible that it's from an animal that stranded and decomposed and washed its bones ashore. You know, it's hard to say, really. From looking at these bones, I wouldn't have picked them out as not being sea cow because they seem solid enough, but they're very light for their weight or for their size. And sea cow bone just isn't. It's not light. No matter what you do, it's not light.
It's basically like elephant bone, isn't it?
It's just like elephant bone since they're related. So, yeah.
You mentioned earlier on that you have undergraduates in your lab doing a lot of work with you, but you've also worked with high school students on genetics too. So can you explain the sort of projects that you're doing with undergraduates and have done with high schoolers?
I didn't see there was any reason why they couldn't just keep going with what I was doing. So that's what all of my undergraduate students have done. We have a program at George Mason called OSCAR, which gets students involved in research. And so I've had a number of students come through that program to work in the lab. And, you know, there's no reason that they can't do what I was doing. It's painful. It's frustrating. I had a student last fall, in 2019 fall, who was trying to set up a new extraction for crab shell. And he just had a heck of a time. And I thought, wow, I thought it was just sea cow. But here, no, it's just DNA. Yeah. In little tiny labs is just a real bear to get to work.
Yeah, people tend to think that with DNA, you can just sort of stick it in a test tube, squirt something on it, and then put it in the machine and out come your results. Because that's what happens on TV.
I want that machine. I totally do. Yeah, we stick our DNA. Well, first we have to grind it out of the bone, which is a fascinating process anyway, because it kind of smells the way your teeth smell when the dentist is drilling them in your head. So it's a very off-putting smell. So we drill the bone to powder slowly and carefully to not break up the DNA anymore. And then we let it sit around in nice warm temperatures and rock about for 4 or 5 days. You know, so our first step takes 4 or 5 days. Yeah, and the rest of it's no shorter. So, but the undergraduates have been doing the identification program, and I actually had the whole microsatellite experiment program was started by one of my undergraduates. He wanted to come on and do research with me, and we sat down and talked about it, and I said to him, well, what are you interested in? And he said, well, I don't know, what do you think? And I said, well, I really want to try and identify these bones to the individual level. And he said, oh, that sounds cool. And he took it and ran with it for a couple of years. So we got a lot done at that point. And then I had another undergraduate who's now in Sweden, the evolutionary graduate school in Uppsala doing work. Brilliant. This guy is just, he was brilliant. And he took that project even farther. So all I really need now is another, well, okay, is a lab and another undergraduate who wants to get it the next step, which should really make it fairly simple to do. Not ever going to be cheap, but fairly simple, because the primers to be able to identify to the individual level are $100 or more each instead of seven. So, yeah, that's exciting. But we'll see if we ever go back to school.
And you've also had high schoolers working with you as well.
I had a really, really good one last year. She came in and was working with a student who was working on the crab. So he started out by working on sea cow and got really frustrated with that. I could understand. It's very frustrating. But they started that project, and then they started working on the project with the crab. His idea was to see if you could do individual identification on crab shells rather than having to pick up an animal and kill it and identify it. You could get all that same information from shed crab shells, which is a great idea. I liked it, but you know, takes a little bit longer than 3 months to get something like that really running.
And talking sort of non-invasive methods, you've recently branched out into another marine mammal with Kelsey Smith, looking at narwhals.
What a cool animal. Gosh, I didn't know there were any cool whales out there. No, actually, I love belugas. Blues are my favorites. But narwhals are, you know, I think they're going to push belugas off the top for me. They're just very, very interesting and weird beasts. And we spent some time trying to see if we could extract good DNA from the tooth of these animals. And tooth extraction turns out to be almost as bad as bone extraction, but eventually we got it to work. And then we got kind of held up in the middle and we couldn't figure out what the problem was, because we're running the same exact procedure that we've had running before, and now it's not working. We're like, what the heck? And so we tracked it back to a power spike that destroyed our PCR machine. And after that happened, we couldn't get our process to work anymore. So we had to go back and tinker with the time or the temperature on the reaction to try and get the thing to work again, because now we've got a totally different PCR machine. That's just some of the frustrations. That's why people call PCR black magic, man. I mean, there are people who sacrifice chickens and tons of other stuff to try and get PCR to work.
So with this narwhal project, you've developed a way to basically extract tiny bits of narwhal tooth so you don't damage museum specimens?
Yeah, it's true. Kelsey's main idea was to try and look at the difference between carefully grinding the outside or the inside, especially. It'd be nice to be able to take the very inside of the tusk, because then that doesn't impact what you see on the outside at all. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's the thought process behind this. What we've found with the sea cow is drilling into the bone really gives us the best DNA. So the question with the narwhal was, is drilling into the tooth going to give you the best DNA? Or could you get it by very carefully taking the edges of the bone off and extracting from that?
Because some of the historical narwhal tusks are historical. They belong to Mary, Queen of Scots, or the Danish royal family.
You can't be messing around with that stuff, or you're going to jail in some country for the rest of your life. Yeah. So what we found was that there was absolutely no difference. You know, if the tooth produced good DNA, it didn't matter what we did on the grinding or drilling side. So we could make it look like it had never happened. With museum specimens, they're always grumpy about if you damage the specimen or you change the specimen, drill into it or something, then you're going to lose some of the biological information that you might be able to get out of that specimen. But with museum specimens, all they care about is that you don't mess it up. Mm. So that kind of makes it easier because you're not trying to preserve the biology. You're just trying not to mess up their specimen or their museum display. So we have a way that we think is going to work really well. And although narwhal tooth, I'm not sure that, you know, if you've got any size piece of narwhal tooth, you're going to know it's narwhal. It's so distinctive. You know, so, but it was an interesting project because we were looking to see whether there was a difference in the method of extracting the pieces of bone. So that was kind of fun. I enjoyed doing that with her. But she's taken any number of undergraduate students, you know, who come in and worked with them. And so, you know, she's had a good crew. We've had a really good crew who've worked with us over the years.
So now, theoretically, you could go to some of these medieval narwhal bones or unicorn horns, theoretically, and analyze them for DNA.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe we'll find a unicorn horn.
Yeah, if you find an odd one that doesn't match narwhals, I think you found your unicorn.
Yeah, that'd be kind of cool.
To go with your stellar sea monkey.
Yeah. Although you never know whether it could be a, what are they calling it, a narluga?
Mm.
That recent hybrid that they've found. But the narwhal has a really, really, really distinctive tusk. Mm. So.
Yeah, it's hard to mistake that for anything else.
It really is. You know, it's pretty easy to mistake stellar sea cow bone for, in a small size piece, you can mistake lots of things for stellar sea cow bone, but not narwhal. So I'm hoping that Kelsey will go on and do her PhD. Of course, you know, like everybody who does this kind of thing, she's got to get a job now and earn some money before she can go forward with that. But I'd love to, as I know you would like to be on that project because of our shared interest in medieval history.
Medieval history, absolutely.
Stuff like that.
Well, Kelsey was telling me at the moment she's trying to work with COVID labs to help them up during the pandemic.
Yeah, she told me that too.
Good for her.
But I mean, she's totally got the skill for it. DNA extraction. I mean, she's going to extract. She's going to extract from these crazy viruses, and she's never going to want to go back to doing whales
and machines that work.
Every single time, it's the same. Yeah, ancient DNA is no joke. I mean, and even though we've been told more than once by people that we are not really working with ancient, because our animals aren't, or our specimens aren't more than about 1,000 years old, that's hardly anything.
It's a little bit like antiques. It's not antique unless it's more than 100 years old. If it's 50 years old, it's vintage. So you're working on vintage DNA.
Yeah, we're kind of, I guess we should say that. We're working on vintage DNA.
Well, it's been fantastic having a chat with you, Lorelei. I actually learned quite a bit about Stella, which I hadn't known before.
How can that be?
And hopefully some of the potential students who are listening to this, who are thinking about getting into DNA analysis.
I have no money.
Well, yeah, maybe realize it's a little bit more expensive and a little bit more difficult than they might be led to believe by the TV shows.
Yeah, it is a bit more difficult. And, you know, with living tissue, it's so easy. That's the thing that's been pointed out to us so many times during this project, because we always use manatee blood as our control. So we extract from blood all the time. And it's just, it's ridiculous how easy it is compared to what we do with the bone.
And hopefully there are some undergraduates and high school students out there who might be listening as well, who realize that they can also get involved in marine mammal research potentially if they contact a local lab and see if they're willing to take them on.
Yeah, unfortunately, we're not open right now. So I do get people contact me all the time, but unfortunately, we're non-essential personnel according to the school. So we're relegated to working from home.
Well, hopefully we get back into the schools relatively soon.
Well, keep good thought on that one.
Well, thanks very much for chatting to me.
Oh, no problem.
And thank you very much for tuning in, listeners.
The Marine Mammal Science Podcast is produced by Speak Up for Blue Media on behalf of the Society for Marine Mammalogy. The episode was hosted and produced by Dr. Chris Parsons. The editors were Chris Parsons and Andrew Lewin.
Those who are interested in sponsoring an episode or featuring advertising on the podcast should contact Chris at speakupforblue.com. It should be noted that any opinions expressed by the host or guests do not necessarily reflect those of the Society for Marine Mammalogy. In addition, if products, companies, or university programs are featured in this podcast episode, it does not imply endorsement of these by the Society for Marine Mammalogy. The theme music is by Kevin MacLeod of Incomptech and is used under Creative Commons license.